Well, sounds like a lot of stories.
No. I think we got the stories. We even had a few Chazaron stories. Okay. So, but thank you again for bearing with us in the experimental evolving of part of the Smicha program as part of our constant efforts to update and improve the program, and we appreciate your indulgence. We're going to try and review some of the things that Rabbi Willig touched upon, kind of solidify them, try and bring some other perspectives that I have garnered from the years that I did this with Rabbi Gleich, my own personal experiences. And we'll try and touch on some issues perhaps that Rabbi Willig didn't get to. But we're really going to focus on three stages. Before the, you know, the wedding or the marriage has been arranged, then before the, you know, the ksuba, before you ever get to the wedding hall, and then what to do at the wedding hall. So in terms of shiduchim and revealing stuff in the process of dating, which we will have dealt with last year, I don't think he dealt with it so much this year, the Chafetz Chaim writes in the Sefer Chafetz Chaim towards the end, based on the Gemara Masechtas Chulin, the one is obligated to reveal all relevant information to the other party, because if you don't do so, it could be a possibility of a mekach tos, or one could be in violation of the iser of Gnevas Das. And that would not only be incumbent upon the prospective chasen or kala, but even a third party who's aware of this information, certainly the rabbi as well, will be obligated to reveal this information, and a failure to do so might put one in violation of the loisase of loisamer adam reyachach. I shouldn't allow my friend to make a grave mistake. If I had knowledge, I could have prevented it. Even if it was told to you in confidence, the poskim feel that everything is really told in confidence. You know, we assume that there's generally confidence even between two people who are not necessarily bound by legal confidences. All things that are told to us are assumed to be told in confidence. At the same time, we have an obligation to reveal it because of loisamer adam reyachach. So even if it was told to a person in a professional context, we'd be obligated to reveal it. Rabbi Willig didn't think you had to lose your job over that, but perhaps a discussion for another time. Okay, the stipler, though, the question that's discussed by the poskim is what is called relevant information. So the stipler has in his sefer and Masechtas Yevamos that it's only those items, or the severity of an item, the severity of an issue, that would nullify the marriage even after it has been carried out, meaning it would render the marriage a kiddush etos. So that kind of information, that's what you have to reveal beforehand. Anything that doesn't reach that threshold, you don't have to reveal, which is a very high threshold. Not too many things render the marriage kiddush etos. We'll discuss. He didn't discuss it this year, actually. Kiddush etos. I mean, we're talking about the issues of impotence, or you know, a person converted to another religion. I mean, you're talking about a very high threshold, a high bar in terms of what could render a marriage a kiddush etos. However, Dr. Abraham in the Sefer Nishmas Avram quotes in the name of Rebbe Yashiv, who had a much lower standard. Whatever most people would be interested in knowing is one is obligated to reveal. And the Chazon Ish felt, huh?
Just interested?
Like, meaning anything that most people would want to know beforehand, that's what you're obligated to reveal. If it's just an interesting tidbit, but some people would be interested in it. Some people, you know, not interested, but it will make a difference in their decision, then you have to let them know. People are interested in any, as we see in our times, any pieces of information, no matter how relevant or not, but it means something that would influence their decision-making process. The Chazon Ish writes that one should reveal all relevant information, because otherwise, you know, just as an Eitzah Tova, there'll be Tarumos, he writes, L'Kol HaChayim. People will always bring it up whenever there's a bump in the road in the marriage, and by the way, you never told me about X, Y, or Z, which is definitely true in terms of my experience, that does happen. So it's always best to be up front. At the same time, the poets can say, you don't have to reveal it on the first date. The Stipler writes, or Chazon Ish writes, or Moshe has in his Tshuvos, you don't have to reveal it right away. Rather, the Chazon Ish says, Lekras HaSoif, towards the end of the Shidduch process. Rabbi Willig has his position that halfway through, because otherwise you're wasting the other party's time. You know, if at the end they're just going to throw away the whole thing because of this piece of information you revealed, so it's not fair to either party, so kind of as a pshara, he feels that halfway through. But the Chazon Ish writes towards the end, Ramosha says when you feel that the Shidduch is likely going to happen, then you should reveal the information.
What does halfway through mean? Anything specifically for?
Halfway through what he called the typical dating process in your social context. So, depending everybody...
I'm willing to say, if you go on 12 dates or the 6th date?
Sixth date, right. But some, you know, so if you date for 6 months, 3 months, right. However, at the same time, if someone asks you a pointed question, certainly you have no heter to lie. I mean, this is all, what kind of information do you have to reveal without being asked? But if a person is asked, then I don't think that, obviously it became relevant information, there's no heter to lie. Rabbi Willig was, once though the shidduch, you know, is arranged and people are interested in getting married, Rabbi Willig felt that it is the role of the rabbi or the role of the Rosh Yeshiva even to meet with a prospective couple before the marriage and discuss all matters of yuchsin relating to the couple, relating to the family. As he said, the buck stops with the Masader Kiddushin, and this is part of his maximalist approach to Seder Kiddushin, of really dictating what goes on at a wedding. Just Beinenu, you know, that fits in with his personality and the way he runs his rabbonus in general. But, you know, some of the things that he does, I wouldn't recommend you try at home. You know, it doesn't always work out the way it works out for him. Okay, so, but that's part of his maximalist approach. I will tell you that Rabbi Bleich disagreed almost. He felt that the rabbi does not have an obligation to ask about these matters, because the Shulchan Aruch tells us in Simon Beis, based in the Gemara Masechtas Kiddushin, that call mishpachas becheskes ksheres hein. All families have a supposed or assumed status of being becheskes kashrus, and the Beis Shmuel writes over there in Simon Beis, perhaps this is only by mishpacha yedua, famous family we've all heard about, but the Aruch HaShulchan says, no, even not a mishpacha yedua, so the Chazon Ish paskins, if the person presents themselves as a Yid, we have the right to assume that they are, in fact, a miyuchasdik a Yid. And perhaps there's a riot to this from the Gemara Masechtas Yevamos. The Gemara says, Masechtas Yevamos, Daf Mem Hei Amud Aleph, in the sugya of an Eved Va'akum Haboa Bas Yisrael, if you have a non-Jew who, I'm sorry, the product of a relationship between a non-Jew and a Jewish woman, so the child is Jewish, but there's a long discussion in the Gemara. So the Gemara concludes that, at least according to some opinions, he is a Yid, which is the way we paskin. But there was a certain individual presented himself to one of the Amorim. He said, but how am I going to get married? He said, you're a Yid. He said, but how am I going to find the Shidduch? He said, well, will you let me marry your daughter? He said, not a chance. You know, even though you're Jewish, but he wasn't interested in him marrying his daughter. So he said, so how am I going to find the Shidduch? So he told him, oh, Gali or Nasa Bas Minoch. Either go to Galus or marry another person in a similar situation. How is it going to help that he's going to go to Galus? So Rashi explains, no one will know your situation. So the Stipler writes, you see, you don't have to reveal that the father is a guy. Well, that sounds like relevant information to most people, that the Mechutin is a guy. But the Stipler says, you see from here, it's a very high threshold about what you have to reveal. But perhaps you see from here another additional point of information, and that is that we no one asked about his family when he just presented himself in this new place. So obviously we assume that people who present themselves as Jewish are from a mishpacha miyucheses, and we don't have to necessarily look into the issue. Yeah.
If you know,
if there's a latest hasafik, you know that something occurred, then yeah, everyone would agree. Then at that point, you have to do due diligence. But if it wasn't presented to you, you don't have to give them the third degree, as we will, you know, kind of presented it. The buck stops with you. We assume that people are cheskes sheiros. Yeah.
Does this never change? Like, you know, like society's only gone down a little bit in 30 years from now.
Perhaps. Rabbi Wilk was of the opinion that if a balas tshuva was on a secular college campus when she wasn't religious, so then we assume, unless, you know, known otherwise, that she was nivala la'akum and she's pasul la'kahuna. Rabbi Bleich disagreed. He said, no, all women are b'chetzkas, you know, psulois, and we shouldn't presume that the status has changed, even though, obviously, we know what goes on in college campuses. He didn't feel he even had an obligation to ask about it. If she tells you that she did, you know, that she had relationships with people, so then that's something to look into. But otherwise, we don't have to necessarily ask. And many Rosh Yeshiva, and even in our own yeshiva, clearly do not subscribe to the same position as Rabbi Willig, that you have to investigate the yichus of the family before you officiate at a wedding. But that was his position. The Shulchan Aruch tells us in Simon Aleph, regard to the mitzvah midiraisa of Puruvu, that the basic mitzvah, quotes the opinion of Beis Hillel from the Gemara Masechtas Yevamos, the basic mitzvah Puruvu is to have one boy and one girl. Zachar Nenekeva, because the pasuk says Loiso Barol Leshevis Yitzara, that the world was created to be settled, and just like the human race was started with one Zachar and one Nekeva, so too, if you want to perpetuate the human race, you would also need one Zachar and one Nekeva. And the mitzvah Puruvu perhaps is about perpetuating or participating in perpetuating the human race, and therefore you have to have a Zachar and a Nekeva. Then the Gemara tells us in Masechtas Yevamos that that's the basic mitzvah peruvu, but above and beyond that, based on the pasuk, can say for Koheles, Bebokas, Zerah, Zerechu, La'orev, El Tanach Yadecha, there's a mitzvah to continue to have children even La'orev, even later on in a person's life, El Tanach Yadecha, you should continue to be Zerah, Zerecha, a person should continue to have children. The nature, though, of that mitzvah seems to be somewhat of a dispute in the Rishonim. If you look in the Shulchan Aruch, Simen Aleph, Sifches, so the Shulchan Aruch quotes Machlokes in the Ramban and the Baal HaMoor, whether or not we would sell a Sefer Torah for the mitzvah of La'arav al Tanach Yadecha. One of the mitzvahs that's unique, that we sell a Sefer Torah in order to fulfill the mitzvah, is Peruvu. So is La'arav al Tanach Yadecha also receive that unique status, and we would sell a Sefer Torah for La'arav al Tanach Yadecha, or not? Machlokes in the Ramban and the Baal HaMoor, two opinions in Shulchan Aruch. See, Achrenim understood that perhaps this machlekes touches upon really a conceptual issue in terms of la'arav al tanach yadecha. What is the nature of that mitzvah? Is it kind of like an extension of pruvu? Midei raisa, you only have to have a zachar and a keva, but perhaps la'arav al tanach yadecha extends pruvu, and you have an obligation to have as many children as possible. In which case, it would receive the same status as pruvu. You could even sell a sefer Torah to fulfill it. Or perhaps it's just like a hidur mitzvah. It's not pruvu. It's a nice idea, you know, v'la'arav al tanach yadecha, but pasuk can say for Koheles, it's the right thing to do, but it's not the same as pruvu, not the same type of obligation, perhaps just a hidur mitzvah. In case we would not sell a sefer Torah in order to fulfill it. So the Aruch HaShulchan and the Berakha Yosef have a diuk in the language of the Rambam that he feels that it is not an obligation in the same sense as Puruvu, more of a Hidur Mitzvah. Because the Rambam writes, in order to fulfill Puruvu, you have to be Boelas Ishta B'chol Oina. You have to constantly be attempting to fulfill Puruvu until you have a Zachar and a Nekeva. But when it comes to V'arva Tanach Yadecha, he doesn't make such a claim that you have to be Boel B'chol Oina in order to fulfill it. So the Aruch HaShulchan and the Birkei Yosef at the beginning of Evan Ezer say that it sounds like from the Rambam that this is just like, you know, it's a Hidur mitzvah, and therefore there isn't the same urgency attached to it that you have to fulfill it as soon as possible. So it sounds like from that, the language of the Rambam, the V'arav al Tanach Yadecha, you could push off, meaning if a person, let's say, has already fulfilled the basic mitzvah of Peruvu, and then he's interested in delaying V'arav al Tanach Yadecha because of, you know, circumstances in his life. So it sounds like that's not something that's necessarily objectionable entirely. However, when it comes to Peruvu, it sounds like from the Rambam that there is a sense of urgency and a person should try and fulfill it as soon as possible. And it sounds like that's not only because Rizim Magdim and LeMitzvahs, the concept we have by all mitzvahs, but the Chazon Ish writes in Negoim, which many Achronim quote, that whenever you have a mitzvah that doesn't have limited to a, whenever you have a mitzvah, the She'en Lazman Kavua, it's not limited to a specific time, necessarily, it's something that you have to do in your life. Every moment that you postpone it is kind of like a bitul mitzvah. So postponing the pruvu, which is a lifetime mitzvah, you have your whole life to do it, every moment that you postpone it is a kind of bitul mitzvah. So it's even more severe. So therefore, Rabbi Willig stressed and emphatically that he has never been, or I think he said, he has never been Masadik Kiddushin for a couple that started out on birth control, and he gave a, you know, ringing endorsement to his aide Justin that he developed with the endocrinologist from Riverdale, that which is a better Eitzah to controlling the cycle before a wedding to avoid a Chuppas Nida, and in that way a couple shouldn't start out being on birth control. He has commented, though, in the past, though, that after you fulfill Peruvu, or even within the Zachar and the Nekeva, that there's room for spacing. Quoting the name of Rabbi Henkin, that was the opinion of the Marsham, Rabbi Avadia, is that a person has a right, you don't have to have, let's say, once you have a Zachar, to right away try and to have a Nekeva, even within the first year. Rabbi Willig felt in the first year already wasn't healthy for the woman. And a person has the latitude to delay it, the place can say, even till 2 years, some even further, because the Gemara says you're allowed to nurse a child, the first child, for maybe even up to 4 or 5 years. And the Gemara Nida says that a woman who just gave birth has a certain quasi-chayla status for 2 years. So you see that you have some latitude in terms of separating between even the first child and the second child. And the spacing isn't totally objectionable. Rav Moshe Negris Moshe is not happy about that. He quotes that there was a minhag ha'poskim to delay for 2 years. He quotes spacing, and he was not happy about it. But at the same time, that was the minhag by many, Rabbi Henkin and others, was that it's mutter to space up to 2 years, and Rabbi Willig was also seemed to be of that opinion. But, and when it came to Arvel Tanachedech, he also conceded that a person could delay for one circumstance or the other. But he was not in favor, I don't think he mentioned it this year, but he mentioned it last year, in favor of delaying having children, even for Arvel Tanachedech, because of financial concerns. He thought that was part of bitachin, that a person should have as many children, and the finances shouldn't play into it. That was his opinion. However, others disagree. You should be aware of that. The Mishnah tells us in Masechtas Avos that when is a person supposed to get married? Ben Yud Ches L'Chuppah. Why? What, the Beishmu OS over here, Simon Aleph, Sivkat and Gimel, why is it Ben Yud Ches L'Chuppah? Most mitzvahs start out when a person is 13. How come Pruvu is only when a person is 18? So the Beis Shmuel explains, because the Gemara tells us in Kiddushin, Rechaim b'tzavar v'yasek b'tayra, if a person has the Ola Parnasa, there's no way he's going to be able to learn Torah. So the child, the person, when he's developing, and the Mishnah and Avos gives a person this, you know, curriculum for the first 18 years of his life, you know, ben chamesh lemikra, ben eser lemishnah, chamesh esrei l'talmud. So when he's 18, he's finished the basic curriculum of Talmud Torah, now he can begin to engage in Peruvu. But before then, it will interrupt his Talmud Torah, and therefore he's allowed to delay Peruvu. This could be, perhaps, because Peruvu, not only because it's like a kind of Oisik B'mitzvah Potem in our mitzvah, but also because Peruvu is all about transmitting the Masorah to the next generation. It's quoted here in the Shulchan Aruch that... Let's say a person has children, a big goyusai, when he's a goy, and then he converts. So it's a machlekes in the Gemara between Yevamos, between Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish, whether or not he fulfills Peruvu with the children that he had big goyusai. And we passing like Rabbi Yochanan that he does. You do fulfill Peruvu with the children you had big goyusai. However, the Rambam adds, and this doesn't appear in the Gemara, that that's only if Nisgairu Imoy, they convert with you. I mean, they have to be Jewish children. It's quoted over here in the Shulchan Aruch, Simon Aleph, Siv Zayim. The children have to be Jewish. Why do they have to convert along with you? They don't have to be born Jews, but they have to be Jews, they have to have converted too. Why? So the Shechtas explained, others explained too, is because the whole mitzvah Peruvu, Minchas Chinuch notes, is not the same as the mitzvah Peruvu, the mitzvah that we practice, the Peruvu, is not the same mitzvah that was given in Parshas Bereishis, Peruvu, Muluas, Arz V'Kivshua, simply to populate the world. If it would be to populate the world, it should be incumbent upon Bnei Noach too. The mitzvah is not simply to populate the world. The mitzvah, that was initially the mitzvah, but at the time of Kabbalah Satira, the mitzvah was changed and it became limited to Klal Yisrael, and it became to transmit the Messiah from one generation to the next generation. And that's why the children have to be Jewish. Well, for example, Taisus and the Ritva both write, it's quoted in Shulchan Aruch, that you need specifically a Zachar and an Akeva. Beis Hillel's opinion is Davka, but no, Zachar and Akeva, because that's what perpetuates humanity. However, the Yushalmi says, if it's a Zachar and an Akeva, it could be Yitzir Peruvu. So then, Kol Shekein is a Kal V'Chaymer, two males. That's how the Avnei Nezer Paskins, many others Paskin like that. But there's a Zohar HaKadosh, because Moshe Rabbeinu had two children, both sons, and then he separated from his wife. He had Gershon and Eliezer. How could he separate from his wife? He didn't fulfill Peruvu yet. So the Avnei Nezer says, you see from here, I think it's based on a passage in the Zohar, that a person fulfills Peruvu with two boys. If you can't fulfill with a boy and a girl, Kol Shekein says Yushami can fulfill with two boys. What's the Kol Shekein? What's the Kal V'Chaymer? Maybe it's Davka, a boy and a girl, because that's what perpetuates humanity. So perhaps you see from here, no, that was initially the mitzvah Peruvu, Meluas Arz V'Kivshua, was to populate the world. Now it's been changed. And it's about perpetuating the Messiah. So say, if a person can fulfill Peruvu with one boy and one girl, even though the girl doesn't have a mitzvah of Talmud Torah, so Kol Shekein, a person can fulfill the mitzvah with two boys who both participate in the mitzvah of Talmud Torah and can perpetuate the Messiah perhaps even to a greater degree. So if that's what the whole mitzvah is about perpetuating the Messiah, then it makes a lot of sense that we could be Deicha Peruvu in order to learn Torah. And even when a person is 18 years old, we don't demand that everybody get married at 18. We're understanding that some people need to want to learn Torah more. And it's commonplace in our time and context to push off getting married much later, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23. Some yeshivas had the saying 24, not before. So now it's become more in vogue to get married younger again. But we'd have no problem being doicha, people getting married, in order so they should be able to learn Torah. So for that reason, Rabbi Schechter is of the opinion, he told me many times, that he believes there's no difference if a person is married or not married. Let's say a person feels, for whatever reason, he found the right girl, would like to get married, even though he's still learning in yeshiva. He's still an undergraduate. But, you know, to get married doesn't derail him from his plans of Talmud Torah. But if he's going to start having a family while he's still an undergraduate or still in yeshiva, or perhaps, you know, in his basic schooling, so then that's going to curtail his ability to learn Torah to the degree that he would like. So the same way we push it off, we understand when a person's 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, you know, that a person wants to learn Torah and therefore he's not ready to get married yet. So too, even if a person's married, but they feel they're not ready to start a family yet, it's going to interrupt their ability to learn Torah and to be able to pass on the Masorah to the next generation, to be able to practice birth control, even though they are married. So Rabbi Willig responded to that if you're old enough to get married, then you're old enough to have children too. So there's two perspectives about this issue. And Rabbi Schechter felt that when it comes to v'la'arvel tanach yadecha, financial concerns are a reason to perhaps delay or, you know, figuring out family planning beyond the basic mitzvah of Purvu, finances can play into it. They once gave two shiurim for Judah Diamond, you know, who runs Torah Web, about this issue, one right after the other. So Rabbi Willig got up, said his position, and then Rabbi Schechter got up, he said, with all due respects, and then he said, you could listen to it, it's all online, said his, about tuition and family planning, said his position. You should be aware of both. Even before, though, we get to filling out the ksuba and things, once the couple decided they want to get married, so we will discuss at length the topic of the halachic prenup, which of course was his kind of innovation. But it has received a broad support, obviously. So the major two hurdles of this halachic prenup, which he addressed at length, are that it should not be a forced get. So you can't impose a financial penalty on a husband who doesn't want to give a get. That would be, because if he gives a get to avoid a financial penalty, so Rama says, that's not appropriate. It might be considered to be a get me'usa, a forced get. And the second hurdle is that conditional financial obligation, that I'll incur a financial obligation if such and such circumstances arise, that is always a problem of an asmachta. So Rabbi Willig tried to explain that we could avoid the issue of asmachta by making it me'achshav u'be'ez din choshuv. If you do it in a significant basin and you make it take effect now, so then that mitigates perhaps the asmachta concern because it's taking place already right now and you do recognize that this could come to pass for the fact that it's taking place in a basin choshuv. And in terms of the issue of get me'usa, so he tried to argue that the amount that they impose is not a knas, but rather the regular obligation of mezainos that every husband is obligated to support his wife. And then he explained that, you know, in order to make it effective, we'd have to allow the woman to keep her own ma'aseh yadayim, and we have to allow the husband has to therefore withdraw from all claims to her wages. And he discussed when you're supposed to do that in the course of getting married. Ideally, it should be between Eretzin and Nisuin, but perhaps you can do it before. And we discussed all the different permutations of that. Others had advanced a different type of prenup, but basically same idea, just imposing the financial obligation from the beginning of the marriage. And the wife could be Michael until such time comes that she doesn't want to be Michael. In which case, the obligation always existed. It's not a knas, and it's not an asmachta. It was never conditional. He's obligating himself from the moment they get married to pay her X, Y, and Z sum every day. And if she'll decide to be Michael, she can be Michael. And if she decides not, she doesn't want to be Michael, she doesn't have to be Michael. Yeah.
Isn't that Ray Willis? Is it a different one?
That was a different one.
Is that more of a...
That was Rabbi Black's. He alluded to Rabbi Black's prenup. That was
but not his most popular son, Rabbi Willis.
Rabbi Black's never, the Mazel had it, and it never made it. out of.
Even though it seems to avoid the issue much better.
Yeah, because they didn't want to make it that every husband is imposing upon himself financial obligations that are seem extreme from the beginning of the marriage. It just becomes, it was clumsy, that's what he said. Because then there's obligations that are there that, you know, just get, makes things more thorny. Yeah.
Rabbi supports the prenup in general, the Musa part. He's okay.
So he's opposed to Rabbi Willig's prenup because he feels that it is an asmachta, it's a conditional financial obligation. The question if Me'ashim Bebezin Choshev solves that problem. And he felt that the amount was looked, it just looks like a knas. When the husband decides he doesn't want to give a get, all of a sudden you impose a financial penalty.
But the Musa doesn't care.
I'm sorry?
He doesn't think it's a Musa.
Rabbi thought it's part of my Siyadayim.
No, so Rabbi doesn't think it's a
Musa. Yeah, so that was what Rabbi Sternbach opposed it to, is that maybe it's too much, so Rabbi Willig adjusted it down to make him happy, and Eretz Yisrael maybe adjust it down, and you could solve some of that, some of those issues. But moving on to filling out the ksuba, Rabbi Bleich always used to introduce the topic of Seder Kiddushin with a scary but important statement that the Gemara says in Masechtas Kiddushin, perhaps you covered it this year, Kol she'eini yodeh b'tiv gittin v'kiddushin lo yehela esek imahen. If you're not a bucky in tiv gittin v'kiddushin, so you shouldn't be involved with it at all. So he said, I don't know what I'm doing here. If you either you're a bucky b'tiv gittin v'kiddushin, in which case you don't need me, and if you're not a bucky b'tiv gittin v'kiddushin, I can't really help you become a bucky b'tiv gittin v'kiddushin. So he said, I don't know what the purpose, I was always happy that he said that. I don't know what the purpose of our shiurim are. It always helps the program when people do that, you know. But anyway, that was one understanding of kosher any odeh b'tiv gittin v'kiddushin lehelo esek imahen. That's like a very basic understanding, you know, understanding it in its simplest form. If you're not a bucky and give v'kiddushin, you shouldn't be involved in either one or the other. And that's how the Pesachei Tshuva quotes from the Shavuos Yaakov in understanding this statement. However, the Maharsha on the Gemara Maseches Kiddushin understands it differently. He asks, why does it begin with gittin and then go to kiddushin? Such a pessimistic view of marriage. It should have said, Kol she'eini yodeh b'tiv kiddushin v'gittin. So therefore, the Maharsha says it's talking about second marriages. You shouldn't be involved in second marriages where you're going to have to look into a get and making sure everything was taken care of properly unless you're a bucky b'tiv gittin v'kiddushin. But first marriages, that he says, anybody wants to be involved in that, you can be involved in that. Much more comforting approach. And the Taz suggests that what it's referring to is to issue an original psak. To do what you know it says in the Madrich, you don't have to be so cunning to figure that out, but if it's an original psak and get in v'kiddushin, that a person should reserve for those who are b'kiyim b'tiv get in v'kiddushin.
Isn't that for any? Why is the chishvig in Taz shouldn't be in here?
No, you might want to issue an original psak and whether you have to repeat benching if you forget al anisim, you know.
Shouldn't do that either, no.
Okay, but if you do, the stakes aren't as high. You make a mistake and get in v'kiddushin, the stakes are pretty high. We could probably add Gairus to the list too. You know, there are a few areas that fit into that mold. But even those who are b'kiyim b'tiv gittin v'kiddushin, but Willig recommended to fill out the ksuba before. You know, don't try and be a hero and fill it out at the chasen's tish. It's always a good idea to fill out the ksuba before, and even to bring an extra copy of the ksuba with you. So therefore, before we get to the wedding ceremony, we'll discuss how filling out the ksuba. Rabbi Moshe, before we get to the ksuba, of course, there was the Tanoim. Rabbi Willig spent a little bit of time on the Tanoim, and Rabbi Moshe has his own nusach of the Tanoim, which really removed a lot of the grave consequences that accompanied Tanoim initially. And most Poskim feel that the Tanoim don't really, since Rabbi Moshe removed all the teeth, you know, the consequences of the Tanoim, they really don't accomplish too much anymore. Since Rabbi Willig felt, you know, it brings extra kibudim, so we should keep it, but the gravity, the severity, and importance of it, therefore, has been minimized. Rabbi Bleich felt that perhaps the reason why we continue the practice of filling out Tanaim is because, based on the Gemara Masechtas Kiddushin, that Rav Man Gidamanda Mekadesh Beloi Shiduchei. Rav gave Malkus to a person who got married without Shiduchim. Meaning there should be some arrangement that takes place. Why? Because he thought that was in order to prevent the drunken sailor effect, which he called, you know, guys on shore leave and they meet a nice girl and have the slingshot wedding. That's why I think in New York, if you want to get a marriage license, you have to wait 24 hours before you use it. So you shouldn't, here for the day and get married, and then later on you have problems in terms of annulling the marriages. So marriage should be arranged. It's not something that should be done, arranged on the spot. So that's perhaps why we continue the practice of Tanoim, is that it should be something that was negotiated beforehand.
But Reb Lach also felt that that's really probably accomplished by the caterer and paying for the photographer, and most of us, the Tanoim is the least of the preparations for the wedding. So again, it's still probably not necessary, but it's the right thing to do. I've never been at a wedding which didn't have Tanoim, so it's the right thing to do to continue the practice. In terms of filling out the ksuba, the first thing that you have to fill out when filling out the ksuba, of course, is the date. It's discussed in the Shulchan Aruch, Simin Kuf Chavav, some of which is on the Mar Mekarmis. But I gave you over here from the Madrich, everybody should have a sheet, you should keep it with you. I would recommend that you memorize this, it's not so hard for the Fina. And it's really not so hard because the days are based on the, if you know Kriya Satar from Parashas Bereishis, the days that follow the same way they're described in the Chumash and Parashas Bereishis. So it's Be'echad B'Shabbos, B'Sheni B'Shabbos, Shlishi B'Shabbos. It's funny that in the Madrich, which is supposed to be, you know, the go-to resource, they have a few mistakes over here. So one is Bashishi is supposed to be Chaser Yud, the way it's written in Chumash. Here they have it Mole Yud. But anyway, it follows the way it is referred to in the Torah. So even if you don't have your Madrich with you and you don't remember how to spell it, if there's a Chumash nearby, you could figure out how to get through the first part of the date. Then you move on to the day of the month. So the day of the month follows Sfiras HaOmer, because Chodesh is Belashen Zachar. So it's all Belashen Zachar, and you put the digits before the 10. So Yom Echad, Shnei Yomim, Shleisha Yomim, but then when you get to the tens, it switches to Yom. Rosh Chodesh is a little complicated because you have, if it's just a one-day Rosh Chodesh, it's Yom Echad, but if it's a two-day Rosh Chodesh, then the 30th day is the only one that's a little bit complicated. The digits before the 10. The year is Belashen Nekeva, so you just write Belashen Nekeva. And there's always a vav in between all of the parts of the year. So it's chameishes alafim u'shva meyoyz vishivim visheva. You'll see the way it goes. Even if you make a mistake, though, so as long as we can tell what you mean, it's probably okay. Like, let's say you leave out chameishes alafim, we probably could figure out that it's not a 5,000-year-old document. So it's something that we could fill in, but if you leave out something that we can't figure out, then it could perhaps be a problem. If we could figure it out, then it's not. The Ramah writes in Siman Kuf Chavav Siv Dawud that we pass an achrayus to sofer, even though the idea of lukucha is going back and collecting from the person who sold him the property. If they get collected from by his bal chayv, that they should be able to get repaid by him. So that's assumed, even if it's not written in the shtar, we assume achrayus tol sofer. So anything, even if it's not written in the shtar, if we could figure it out, it wouldn't necessarily pass on the shtar. How do you know which day to write, though? Let's say the chuppah is taking place one day, or the chassan's tish is happening one day, the chuppah is going to happen a different day. Not so common this time of the year, but around the Nisan time, it could be more common. So Rav Moshe was of the opinion that you should post-date it, because a shtar mukdam is possible, predated shtar, because it could be tired from a kukhoi shaloi kedin. A shtar ma'ukhar is kosher. So Moshe was of the opinion that you should post-date it. Others were not happy with Ramosha's psak, because the chassan at the chassan's tish is makabo kinyan, obligates himself to the obligations of the ksuba by picking up the handkerchief, the pen, the yarmulke of the Masada Kiddushin. In lieu of picking that up, he obligates himself to the obligations of the ksuba. So the problem is, if you're going to post data to the following day after the chassan's tish, when he picks it up, nothing is taking place. And the kinyan is not taking effect till later on. So that's a problem that the Gemara discusses of kolsa kinyono. You're doing a kinyan now, which is not taking place until much later, when the Maisa Kinyan is no longer exists. So to have a Shtar Me'ukhar seems to run into a problem of Kolsa Kinyono. So in the Sefer Ksuba Kehilkasa, he quotes from Shlomo Zalman that you should date it on the date of the Chassan's Tish. Why? Because the Chassan is obligating himself now, assuming that the marriage goes through. But it's not being tired from the kucha shaloi kedin. He's obligating himself from the time of the chassan's tish, assuming that the marriage goes through. And that was Rabbi Shechter's opinion too, is that you should date it from the date of the chassan's tish. And the Nefesh HaRav, he quotes that initially the Rav had the minhag, like Rav Moshe, to post-date it, and later on he predated it, you know, the date of the chassan's tish. I don't know what to do with that. You know, early on in his life, one thing, later on in his life, the other thing. But there's two opinions about what you should do with the chasen tishes one day, and the chuppah is going to be later on. Some do like Ramayisha, they do it the day of the chuppah, and many do the day of the chasen tish. Some sadri kiddushin will encourage a couple not to have this situation and avoid it, to avoid the shayla of when to date the ksuba. In my opinion, that's not fair to impose on the couple. You know, people plan getting married, and it's a halachic problem, which we'll have to take a stand on and, you know, have the guts to figure out how to date the ksuba. But I wouldn't impose upon people how to schedule the wedding differently. So that's the first thing you fill out, of course, is the date. The next thing that you have to fill out in the ksuba is the place. Most feel that the place, yeah.
But how does Beinah Shmashos?
Oh, so if it's Beinah Shmashos, everyone would agree you post the date. Okay. Meaning if the chuppah, if the chasen's tish already is Beinah Shmashos, so then you post date it. Like Ramosha.
And the exact opposite, if the chuppah is maybe taking place during...
Yeah. I think there was still, many would still do the later date. Oh. But in that case, I would feel much more comfortable doing the chasen station.
Okay. I agree with you.
The hardcore Moshe-niks are going to avoid being a Shtambuktam in all circumstances. Yeah.
I don't know if this makes a difference. If we go back in Yisun or the Kiddushin, whether or not... I don't know if it's ever really going to be a problem, because...
That happens right away. You have the Kiddushin right away.
Yeah, right away.
If you have the whole thing, it happens during Shkia.
As with the Bein HaShemash, so then I think most would post date. Yeah, you know, the later date. When you're writing the name of the town, so most are of the opinion that the town should have a descriptive term. If it's a city, it should be called Ir. If you're not sure if it's a city, I would call it Masa. Masa means place. In Get, the word Masa or Ir comes after the name of the town, and Iksuba comes before. So if you're getting married, you know, in Brooklyn, it should be Masa Brooklyn. Masa means here. But typically, in a Get, it always has a descriptive term, and because that seems to be the convention by Get, and most do it by Iksubas as well. It doesn't possible it if you don't do it, but that seems to be the convention. If we generally don't write neighborhoods. So let's say we write the name of the city, you don't write neighborhoods. So if a person is getting married in Washington Heights, you would not write Washington Heights. You generally write the name of the city. At the same time, I'll tell you, it says in the Sefer Nisuin Kilchasa that the Chazon Ish used to write, without any descriptive term, Zichron Meir Bnei Brak, which, you know, is a neighborhood. Zichron Meir is a neighborhood, and there was no descriptive term. So see people write Brooklyn, New York. Brooklyn... is a neighborhood, but Brooklyn is not its own city, but it was Nikva, it was Hukva. We'll get to in a second. Once a city is Hukva, is established for being described a certain way, so then that sticks, even if things later on change. So Brooklyn, I don't know if you know the history, the development of New York City, but the five boroughs, some used to be independent cities in their own. The Brooklyn Bridge brought it together.
That's New York, New York, because that was originally New York.
That was originally New York. Yeah. And Brooklyn was its own city, the Bronx was its own city, Queens was its own city. So because Far Rockaway, even though it's now part of Queens, was also not originally not part of Queens. So that's why some of these have been hukva, have been established for their own names. So Brooklyn, if you get Masada Kedushin of Brooklyn, it should just be Brooklyn then. It's not Brooklyn, New York. It's just Brooklyn. There is no... We don't, generally don't write state names. Why don't we write... we'll get there in 1 second. But you know, Brooklyn, not a typical neighborhood, it's because it's been hukva, l'ksiba, skitin, v'kiddushin, so it should be written Brooklyn. And if you're going to write a state name, sometimes we write state names, or Rabbi Willig said if it's... he felt if it's there's more than one city with the same name and you need to identify it, so then perhaps you should write the name of the state as well. But then it should be identified as the name of the state. Again, it should have a descriptive term. So it should be, let's say, Masa Brooklyn, but Medinas, New York. Shouldn't read just be Brooklyn, New York. Again, you know, many people do otherwise don't really stick to the conventions, but the convention... really should be Masa Brooklyn, and if you're going to write because you're concerned about Brooklyn, Pennsylvania, you're going to write New York, it should be Masa Brooklyn Medinas, New York. You don't have to, but Reb Leich always used to say you're basically just telegraphing your an Eina Yodea B'Tiv Gittin V'Kiddushin. He said if you don't write the descriptive terms, you're basically showing that you don't know what you're doing in terms of Gittin V'Kiddushin. We definitely do not write the names of continents or countries. There were historically exubas that were written like that, but it's all a mistake because these things switch over time. countries. That's why states are generally not written. States switch over times too. Cities rarely change. There are a few cities that everybody knows about that changed because of political Istanbul and Constantinople, St. Petersburg. Many, there are a few cities that changed, but by and large, the names of cities don't change. So that's why we usually write the name of the city as opposed to the name of the state or the country that often do change. When you're writing the name of the city with your descriptive terms, so it should be written based on the general rules of transliteration, which were established when these things were, these towns were established for Ksivas Gittin V'Kiddushin. They were established based on a Yiddish transliteration. That's the system. Does it have to be that way? No, but all of language is just convention. So the way that this is, the convention for writing shtaros is based on the Yiddish transliteration of the names of cities. So that's the way it should go. So, but the Rama writes that everything depends on the way people pronounce it and the way that it's been established. So if a town is established for the first time and it's been established, it should be established based on the way people pronounce it. It doesn't go based on the way it's spelled, it goes based on pronunciation. And so let's say, you know, if you were transliterating the name Stephen, you know, it would not, then it's spelled P-H, it wouldn't be pay, hey, you know, that's not the way you would transliterate. It would be transliterated based on the way that it's pronounced. So therefore, silent letters and double consonants, all of these things don't really fit in to the way things are transliterated. There have been mistakes. Buffalo, the way it's hukzak, the way it's been established to spell it, is with two p's, presumably because it's spelled with two f's. But most assume that that was, even though it's been established and we continue that practice, that was probably a mistake. It should not be the way that it's spelled. It goes based on the way that it's pronounced. So that's why there was a whole big machlekes decades ago about how to spell New York. So if you're going based on the way it's spelled in English, it would be Nun Yud Vav, space, Yud Aleph Resh Kuf, New York. But most of us don't speak a proper English and say New York, we say New York. So therefore, the convention was established that it should be, there was a whole meeting about this, that it should be Nun of the Gudas HaRabonim, whenever that existed. Nun Vav Aleph, Resh Yud Aleph Resh Kuf, Yud Aleph Resh Kuf.
What was it? So was that one
more? Nun Vav Aleph. New York. You'll see on wedding invitations in Nun Yud Vav. But again, that's not from anybody who knew what they were talking about. They probably copied from somebody else's wedding invitation. But the proper way, you should spell it the proper way, is Nun Vav Aleph.
Huh? New Jersey spelled the same way?
So the jis sound doesn't have a parallel in the Hebrew language. So some write gimel with apostrophe. That is no place. Someone decided to do that on their own, but it doesn't fit into the convention of transliteration from the Yiddish convention. So the way that it was most assumed that the J sound gets transliterated is the Dalet Zion Shin. Some have just Dalet Zion J like that. You know, if you put them all together, it kind of comes out with a J sound. So Shechter told me he thought New Jersey was Hukzak as Jersey. Dalet Zion Shin. Vav Yud, Jersey, Resh Zayin Yud, Jersey. It's like 2 years ago, I was Masada Kiddushin at a wedding in New Jersey, and I spelled it, it was in a little town. So Bishalta told me whenever you're being Masada Kiddushin at a little town, he thought you should write the name of the state. So, you know, if you're Masada a little town in New Jersey, and say Garfield, no, Garfield, even Masa Garfield, Bimedinas, New Jersey, who knows where Garfield is? So in Brooklyn, everybody knows where Brooklyn is, but Medina's New Jersey. So I wrote Nun Vav Aleph, Jersey. So there's a rabbi from Teaneck. So he said to me, who told you to spell Jersey like that? So I said, Rabbi Shaffer, that's how he spelled it. So he said, no, that's not how he spelled it. I was at a wedding last week. He did not spell it like that. So I said, first of all, I'm not surprised. Rabbi Shaffer switches things all the time. It's constantly being Chadish. So I said, I'm not surprised. But then there was another Rav who was at the very same wedding who said, I have the ksuba. He was Masada Kiddushin at the other wedding. He had the ksuba on his phone. So he said, no, let's see. And he spelled it Jersey. So he's consistent on this. Anyway, I was very, you know, a few victories you have in life. So But that's, again, it goes based on the way that it's pronounced. The vowels, for those who speak Yiddish, it comes a little bit easier. For us, it's more, foreign, so it becomes a little bit more difficult. But the kamat sound is an aleph. That's generally how it gets transliterated. The segol is an ayin. The tsere and the chirik are both yud. So if the person's name is Leib, so then it's lamed yud beis. That's Leib. That's a tsere. So, the shuruk is a vav. The Pasach and the Shvat generally don't get any vocalization, any nikud. That would be I, like Isaac.
It's a lot live.
If you'd be, your name would be Leib, so then it would be Leibi, so then it would be two yuds.
I would say Leib.
So Rabbi Willard felt, even if your name is Leib, which is written Leib, it was a stat. Chassidim came after. Chassidim came, which is true. Historically, Chassidim came to America later, and it was, the system of transliteration was hukva, was established before the Chassidim came here. So even Leib would be Leib. So it should never be with two yuds. But I don't think that's the case.
I'll tell you one time a great Toronto story that you will not believe about a kid, about because my name is Shlomo Leib.
Oh.
Okay. Well, Mike Suba is one yud, Shaila is the Mesar Gedush is Chassidish.
And he wanted Leib.
He wanted two yuds, we had a whole discussion. Yeah. He settled on it was gonna be one yud, came to the Chasam's Tish, there's a Ksuba, my rabbi Rabbi Folder looks over it, says it's wrong, it's got two yuds, he got it.
Got two yuds.
Yeah.
And what did he say?
A simple thing.
And where is Shlomo Bill and Paskin?
I have to tell you. You'll
privately.
You'll
okay, fine.
I'll tell you this one.
Anyway.
What happened.
Okay. The Pasach and the Shva get no nikud. So let's say Kalman or Zalman, which are both Yiddish names. It's just Kuf Lamin Mem Nun. There's no vocalization in there. But sometimes, once in a while, to mix things up, they put it in. This itself is a whole chachma. It's a whole limud b'fnei atzma. Rabbi Rapp has an uncle, I think, Rabbi Sandrovic, who's a big dayan in Milwaukee, has a whole book called Kuntras Ha'aretz La'Areha, all about this, and he discusses every city with footnotes and how it was established and things back and forth. Anyway, but it's kedai to familiarize yourself with it somewhat, even if you want to, you should always find out cities have a way of being chuchzak as being spelled. So the first thing should always be call the rav of the town and find out how it's been established. But many times it has not been established properly, and you'll have to resort to the rules of transliteration. The U sound, huh?
People have been spelling their names wrong the whole life.
And we'll get to their names. The names, no. Okay. Cities have been chuchzak a certain way. Rabbi Wilk felt the names have not been chuchzak. Also, there's a general rule: you don't have three consonants in a row. So, or three vowels in a row. So, like Lakewood. Lakewood was a big machlekes how it should be spelled, but the way it was established was Lamed Yud Kuf Vav Vav Aleph Vav Dalet. Now, that really should really just have been Lamed Yud Kuf Lake Vud. So the W becomes a V. The W gets in Yiddish is pronounced like a V. V is two vavs. So it should have been Lake Vud. The shuruks had just been a vav, so it should have been lamed yud kuf vav 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 dalet. But that's odd. Or let's say wood burn. So some spell it vav vav aleph vav, even though again it should be three vavs in a row. But again, it depends how it was established, and all these things depends how they get pronounced. Is it big machlekes? Chaylem is one of the trickiest ones to transliterate. Rabbi Henkin writes in his rules of transliteration that it's an Aleph Vav. So let's say the name Rose would be Resh Aleph Vav Zion. But let's say Boca Raton. Boca Raton is Bez. I guess Rabbi Brander must have been Kaveh Boca Raton. I don't know if they were doing Gittin and Kiddushin before he came there. I don't know. But they were Kaveh. It is Bez Aleph Vav. Kuf Aleph. But again, Raton, you could have said, Resh Ayin Tes. Aleph Vav Nun, but he didn't. It was Ratan. I guess that's how they pronounced it then. So it's Aleph. Okay, so the whole system, and it goes based on the way things are pronounced. Some have the Chaylim as an Aleph, like Buffalo or Toronto. The end letter is an Aleph. It's not Aleph Vav. It's just Aleph. So sometimes it's Aleph Vav. Sometimes it's Aleph. Or Milano is Huchsuk. Italy is Huchsuk with just a Vav. So sometimes it's Aleph Vav. Sometimes Aleph. Sometimes Vav. Probably depends who is kaveh. One last vowel, which is unique to our language, doesn't really appear, even in the Yiddish, was the ah. It's like an American sound, Staten Island or Atlanta. So some have it as Ayin, some have it as Aleph. We're not even consistent. San Francisco is one way, San Antonio is another way. Sometimes it's Ayin, sometimes it's Aleph. You look it up, how it's supposed to be transliterated.
Is there like a list? Does the RCA or someone have like a list of all
No, it's a chachma. They don't want people spelling things on their own. So they want you to ask a Dayan or look it up in one of the Sfarim about how to do it. It's not really something.
They don't feel making their own things up. They should
have a list. Yeah, they really should be. So there is a list of towns, how the Rebbe Sendrovic, who's a Dayan, published a list. He has a quick list, a reference list of famous American towns and how they're spelled. But if you're Masada Kiddushin, I was Manalapan. No one was Kaveh Manalapan. So I passed it. You pass it around. I went to Rishefta. He told me one thing. And I passed it around to see how to spell it. The P, the F sound, is always a pay. You should just know that. The P. There is no pay soy feast either. It's just, and the pay, it's just the regular pay. So Philip would be pay yud lamid. If it's ip, you know, then would be just pay. If it's Philippe or E, you know, then it would be a yud pay. So you get creative and argue about all these things. It's fun to argue about it. The TH sound is always a test, never a tough test. Okay. So, but once you figure out how you're supposed to spell the name of the city, either it's been hukva one way or you employ the rules of transliteration, then you have to put in the names of the chasen and the kaho. The names of the chasen and kaho appear in the ksuba six times. The first time it's with the parents, with the father's name. The second and the last time it's with the father's name. The middle times it's not with the father's name. It's just the chasen and the kala. And Rabbi Willig discussed at length, should you put Hakayin every time? Should you put Halevi every time? Important discussion. At the beginning, the first time it's Habachar. After that, it's always Chasan Denan, because the Ksuba tells the story of the wedding, and then at the beginning is Habachar. Later on, it becomes a Chasan and a Kala. If a person has two names, it's always written on the same line. Sometimes people are printing up Ksubas on the computer, especially if you're using, you know, one of the newer type Nuschos of Rabbi Scheffler and Dr. Steinberg and all these things. Dr. Steiner, so then you have it on your computer, and sometimes the computer justifies lines and misses up names. So if the guy's name is Chaim Yankov, so his name should be written on one line, Chaim Yankov, because the Sfarim write, based on Inyane Kabbalah, that's one name. For example, if you're naming after, you know, an Elta Zayda, and the Elta Zayda's name was Chaim, and you name him Chaim Yankov, I hate to spoil anybody's parade, but that's really a different name. Chaim Yankov is a different name than Chaim or Yaakov, two totally separate names. That's why if you're adding a name to a chayla, you add, let's say, the guy's name was Yaakov, you add Chaim, that's like a new name. Chaim Yaakov is a different name than Chaim or Yaakov. So since it's one name, it should really be written on the same line of the ksuba. The ben, let's say Moshe Yaakov, could be written on the next line. If a person doesn't have a Jewish name, so then you don't necessarily have to give him a Jewish name for the ksuba. You could transliterate his English name. You have that by Bali Tshuva sometimes. Like, I never had a Hebrew name. There's no mitzvah to give people Hebrew names, despite the practice of Hebrew school teachers. There's no mitzvah to give Uncle Moshe songs. There's no mitzvah to give people Hebrew names. So you could transliterate. Rabbi Bleichos used to boast that in his shul, every Shabbos, to make a mishaberach for June Bas Pauline. They said, we feel no name, no need to give her a Jewish name. If a person has a Jewish name that he was given at birth, and later on it never becomes used, and later on it becomes a Bel Tshuva, now he wants to, or there's a question what to write in the Ksuba. He never was known by that name. It was known as a cradle name, so that is his name for the rest of his life. If it was given to you at birth, that is your name. Even if it was later on not used. If a person has a name from Tanakh, so then it's always written the way it's written in Tanakh. Let's say the guy, his name is David. You don't write Dawid, Yud, Vav, Aleph. His name is written David. Dawid, Vav, Dalid. His name is Moshe. It's not Mem, Vav, Shin, Hey. It's just the way it's written in Tanakh. You don't transliterate biblical names. Yeah.
What about names that are spelled differently in English, but it's in Tanakh?
Like what?
Like Dalbersons has a yud in it.
Yeah, it's always down. But we will made a big point about Aaron, but there's no vav in Aaron, so you shouldn't write it with a vav. Adina and Eliza are biblical names, even though you wouldn't believe it. They do appear in Tanakh. So since it's a biblical name, it should be written with a hey. If it's a Hebrew name, it should be written, everybody will, they're noted with a hey. If it's a Yiddish name, then it should be written it should be written with an aleph. And Rabbi Ulrich didn't feel the need to cater to the way people spell their name necessarily. It should be written properly based on the Yiddish rules of transliteration. So if the name is Fega, it should be written Pei Yud Gimel Aleph, all Yiddish names end in an aleph. And that's the way it should be written, based on the general conventions of how we spell Yiddish names. This brings us to the discussion of writing family names. So Rav Moshe writes in the Igros Moshe that really you should write the family name, Limishpachas, let's say the name is Chaim Yaakov, Limishpachas Stern. Let's say his name is Stern, you know? Okay, so you should write the family name. Why should you write the family name? Because Rav Moshe was Cheshesh Shnei Yaakov Ben Shimon in the same town. Maybe there's two people with the same name living in the same town, so to further identify them, we should use the family name. And Rav Shechter quotes from a Soloveitchik that he was also in favor of writing the family name. And that's what Rabbi Shechter does. He's in favor of writing the family name. Rabbi Willig was hesitant about it because he said then you get involved in machlekes about how to spell family names. We're back to the old problem of transliteration. And they'll say we spell it one way and we don't really care how you spell it. We're going to go based on the convention of how it should be spelled. And problems arise. So Rabbi Willig felt we're not really Choshesh Shnei Yosef Ben Shimon in the same town. And Meikra, then you don't have to write the family name. So he wasn't in favor of writing it, but Rabbi Shechter is in favor of writing it. Rabbi Shechter, though, mitigates Rabbi Willig's concern in that Rabbi Shechter feels that there is no right or wrong way of spelling names. He disagreed with Rabbi Willig. Rabbi Blach also felt like Rabbi Willig. There's a convention of how we spell things, and that's the way it should be spelled. Rabbi Shechter doesn't feel that way. He felt that if I could figure out what you're telling me, unless it's wrong, it's okay, it's acceptable. And you just need to remember how he spells his name. If you've ever seen his name in the front of his sfarim, he spells Shechter Shin Chaf Tes Resh, which is really wrong. It should be spelled Shin Ayin Chaf Tes Ayin Resh, which I think is how Rabbi J.J. Shechter spells Shechter. Because that's with the vowels. It should be Shin Ayin Chaf Tes Ayin Resh. So, some people say Schwartz. How are you going to spell Schwartz? So it should really be spelled Shin Vav Vav Aleph Resh Tzadi. But some, you know, were more influenced by the Israeli spellings. We'll spell it Shin Vez Resh Tzadi, which has nothing to do with the Yiddish transliterations. So Rabbi Shechter felt all of these are okay. It's not. I know what Schwartz means. Shin Vez Resh Tzadi is an Israeli spelling. I can figure out what it's talking about. It's not right or wrong. You know, it's not wrong. And if it's wrong, it's not wrong. It's right.
Is Schwartz originally a Yiddish word?
Schwartz is a Yiddish word. Should be spelled Shin Vav Vav Aleph Resh Tzadi. If I were being Masada Kedushin, that's how I would do it. Rabbi Shechter felt he didn't have to do it. I think Rabbi Ezra Schwartz spelled the Shin Vez Resh Tzadi, which is an Israeli spelling. Yeah. I'll tell you, though, one of my balabatim had, his wife's name is Golda, had a big suffix, how to spell it, this was after, he was looking at the ksuba later on, how do you spell Golda? So he sent a shaila to Reb Chaim Knievsky, because it was, on Matseva was written one way, and the ksuba was written another way, and Reb Chaim Knievsky, he sent a shaila to Reb Chaim Knievsky, how should you spell it? So he sent him back an empty blank postcard. So he said, he went back to the person who brought the shaila to Reb Chaim, he said, he sent me back a blank postcard. He said, no, the answer is in the address. He said, look at the address. He wrote his wife's name and the address. So he wrote, Golda Gimel Vav Lamed Dalet Hey, which is Israeli spelling of Golda. I would have spelled it Gimel Aleph Lamed Dalet Aleph. It's a Yiddish name. So, okay, anyway. So you see that Reb Chaim Knievsky isn't even so opposed to it. If you're going to write the family names, though, it should really be written Limishpachas. But I will tell you that if it was Masada Kedushin once at a wedding, and a man wrote his name, let's say, David Ben Chaim Stern, without Limishpachas. I never saw such a thing before, but the person was a Yodea Sefer. So Rosenzweig was at the wedding, so I just deferred to Rosenzweig. I said, I've never seen this before. He said, that was how Rav Soloveitchik signed his name. Was Yosef Ben Moshe Soloveitchik, without Limishpachas. I said, okay. And the guy was a Talmud of the Rup, so that's... So we let it slide. But typically, it should really be spelled Limishpachas. What if you don't know who the father's name is? Let's say the father was a guy. We know who the father is, but you're not going to write the father's name. He's not Jewish. So it says in Shulchan Aruch, Kuf Chavav, you just write the guy's name. Yehuda? No, Ben. Just Yehuda. The Dagum of Avah disagrees. He says you should write Ben the mother. And that's how the Madrach paskins. If the Madrach is worthy of paskining, they paskin, you should do ben the mother. And the Sefer Ksuba Kehilchasai disagrees, you should do ben Avi Imoy, the maternal grandfather. We find precedent for both. Like, for example, the Gemara says, Ramari Bar Rachel. It goes based on the mother. And we find based on maternal grandfather too. We have Serach Bas Osher, which is was the grandfather, because that's the one who raised him. That was the one who raised him, huh? Oh, Rabbi Bar Bar Chana. Yeah, the son of. You find precedents for all these things. The question is, what's the proper practice? So if you want to write Ben the mother, that's okay. Ben the maternal grandfather, all acceptable. What if a person was adopted and he wants to write the adopted father's name? Just out of kavod. That's how he wants to be known. He doesn't want to be known by his biological father's name. So Ramesha has an igris. Ramesha, you can do that. Like Serach Bas Osher was raised by the grandfather and wrote Bas Osher, which was the grandfather, the one who raised her. But Ramesha says that perhaps you should write a more descriptive term, like Ben Mishinish Takach Shmoy, Vinikra Shmo Ploni, or, you know, Ben Ploni, Demiskeri Ploni, Ben Ploni. Ramesha has different formulations, but either way, he isn't necessarily opposed to it. What if a person is a ger? So the typical description, appellation that's written is Ben Avram Avinu. That's what you're supposed to write. So someone once asked Rabbi Leichen this year, I said the ger is embarrassed to write Ben Avram Avinu. He said, "What?" He said, "You have the biggest yichus in the room. Why would you not want to write Ben Avram Avinu?" So he said, "There's nothing to be embarrassed about." And he felt we should not cater to those kinds of sensitivities. But we cannot be so harsh in our treatment of gerim. And in the Sefer Mishnas HaGer, which is a newer Sefer in Hilchos Geirus, says if the ger, especially a male ger, doesn't want to be known as Ben Avram Avinu, we can, there really isn't any consequence of switching the name to Ben something else. He doesn't need to be identified for any yichus purposes as a ger, so you could write whatever he wants to write. Gerim do it all the time.
You could write Ben Avram, but it's Avram Avinu.
People do Ben Avram.
Yeah,
Avram Ben Avram, yeah. What?
No, I never heard anyone like say Ben Avram Avinu.
Right. Most would be embarrassed about it. But a woman, a female GRS, it should be identified because it's going to have ramifications for Yuchsin. So if she's sensitive about it, you could do the whole Tuksuba solution, which we'll get to in a second. The status of the woman should be written in the Ksuba, identified in the Ksuba. This is in Simon Samach Vav Sif Yud Aleph. You can look it up. Because it has ramifications in terms of if she's a nivela lapasala, or if she's a giara, she's not allowed to marry a kayin, and therefore should be identified in the ksuba. If she was just nivela, but it wasn't to a person who she's pasled to, she's just a regular ba'ula, so Ramosha has an igris. Ramosha, as long as the husband knows about it, then he could write basultada, and he could give, you know, because he could obligate himself with more money than he has to, and she's not pasled to kahuna. It's just a monetary issue, and he could obligate himself more money. You could write basul tada.
It's not a lie. It's
so what? No problem. No problem. But Rabbi Willig always suggested, and he has in that Mordechai, that it's really a double standard then. Let's say the husband had a relationship prior to the wedding, so he doesn't have to divulge that. If the woman did, then she does have to. We might just chalk that up to the other, you know, the whole host of double standards that exist in our society, but Rabbi Willig felt that perhaps if she you know, wants to level the playing field, she could just say that she was Nensa. That's what he suggests in Mordechai. He quotes from Zalman Nechemia. She doesn't have to say she was Nivela Baratzon. She could argue, she could say to the husband, lie, and say that she was Nensa. I think that that's outrageous. So you're gonna start, that's not a skula for Shalom Bayis, is to begin saying that she was Nensa. I don't even understand where he's coming from.
Telling the husband
he's Nensa. Telling the husband, by the way, I was Nensa. Exactly. I don't know where he's coming from, but anyway, yeah. But that she would, if she was, she would have to divulge it to the husband. Even the Masada Kedushin doesn't have to know. She could just be, you know, besul to that. As long as the husband knows, it's all okay. If she's nivela lapasala to an akum, let's say she halachically labeled as a zayna, she's not allowed to marry a kohen, or if she's a giyara, certainly. So then, her status would have to be written in the ksuba. Rabbi Black suggested, by the way, if there's a couple that's living together you know, prior to the marriage, to write Basul Tadah is a joke. You can't do that. And one of the cardinal sins in America is lying. So if you make a public lie, it's just you make a fool of the rabbonis. So he felt, or if she's pregnant, you know, to write pasul to da is totally ridiculous. In the Pischei Tshuva Sifka in Hay, over there in Siman Samach Vav, he discusses perhaps if she's niva, if she was, if it's beula satzmoi, she's beula because they had relations. It could be meikra din, she's entitled to a Messiah mana because she was only nivala al das kiddushin. She was hoping that they would ultimately get married, and therefore perhaps she's entitled to the mana meikra din. Okay, so the status of the woman, we went over the names of the chasen and the kala and the places. So really, that's all that has to be filled out in the ksuba, you know, chazigichim yidai raisa, and all the other blanks that have to be filled in. Once you've filled in all the blanks, what if you have, you know, extra space? Sometimes the ksuba gives you extra room. So Shulchan Aruch says in Simen Mem Hei Sif Yud, ideally speaking, there should not be a blank spaces in the ksuba because you could write in, like, and by the way, I owe you $1 million. So the blank spaces should be filled in. Some had the practice of filling it in, and that's the common practice nowadays, is to fill it in like a check with a line. Even though Rabbi Willard told his interesting story with the Salvation that he wanted to do that, that's not the common practice. Common practice is to fill it in with a line. But because of this concern of blank spaces in the ksuba, Rabbi Bleich made the point emphatically that you shouldn't have a calligraphy ksuba that's in a funny shape. Let's say a couple wants to have the ksuba be written like a dove. So that has many blank spaces all over it. So where you could write something in, because who's to know where the ksuba begins and where it ends? So he felt that that was improper. It should be in the shape of a rectangle, maybe kvetched, maybe an oval or a circle. But or maybe if you have a border around it where there's no blank spaces, then he was, you know, b'deichuk, willing to allow it. But I think there is room for his concern, is that the ksuba should look like a document. It shouldn't have blank spaces all over the place. The same is true, by the way. There shouldn't be blank spaces at the bottom of the shtar. Sometimes in order to people look like the Declaration of Independence, you have like the top of the shtar is the text, and then at the ball way at the bottom, you have like the John Hancock's. So that's improper, because you have all the blank spaces in the middle of the ksuba. The whole reason we write at the end of the ksuba, kol shor v'kayim, is because ein lemeidah b'shita achreina. We don't learn anything out from the last line of the shtar, because you never know, things could be added in. But there shouldn't be many blank lines in between the text of the ksuba and where the edim are signing. So what do? You get to a wedding and there's all these blank spaces. So one Masada Kiddushin once said to me, it's such a pashat eitz, I don't know why I never thought of it on my own. He said, you don't have to write where it says nu'um blank eid. You just write underneath the ksuba. You write it in the signature of the edim. You don't have to follow the instructions all the time in life. So just sign underneath, have the edim sign right underneath the text of the ksuba is the proper thing to do. You cannot fill in the blank spaces with lines. You can't have ksuba line, because it says in Shulchan Aruch, then it looks like the chesimus ha'edim is on the lines, that the lines were done kedasu kedin. So rather, that's what it says in Shulchan Aruch. You have to.
What do you mean by that point?
Let's say I have the text of the ksuba, all the way up here, and the edim over here. So why not just make line? So it says in Shulchan Aruch, because then it looks like the chesimus ha'edim is on the lines. Like if you make a correction in the ksuba, you have to have the edim sign on the side. We saw this correction. So then it looks like it's on the correction, not on the accident. Okay, so this should all be done before you ever show up at the wedding hall. Once you show up at the wedding hall, you have your ksuba filled out, everything's spelled properly, you check the chasen and the kala, all the names are done, the name of the town, you check with the rav of the town. It's all filled out properly, but now once you get to the chasen's tish, so you have to be makabo kinyan for the tnoim from the parents. The two fathers of Makabo Kinyan, if there's no fathers, you do it from the mothers. If there's no mother, Nebuch the Yisaimim, you do it from the Chazen Kala themselves. You Makabo Kinyan on the Tanoim, the witnesses have to see the Kabbalah's Kinyan, and then they sign that they witnessed the Kabbalah's Kinyan. When it comes to the Ksuba, same deal, you Makabo Kinyan from the Chazen, though, this time, that should be done in front of the Edim, and they should all know, says in the Ramah, in Siman Samach Vav Sif Yud Gimel, that the Edom should know that the Chassan knows what he's obligating himself to. So if it's a yeshiva guy, you don't have to explain to this in front of anybody. The Edom and the Chassan are all yeshiva guys, and nothing has to be explained. But it says in the Ramah, if the Chassan doesn't know what it says in the Ksubo, or the witnesses don't know what the Chassan is doing by picking everything up, then the Rav has to explain things to everybody. And it has to be explained in front of the witnesses so that they could witness that the Chassan knew what he was obligating himself to. Because of that, some rabbis have as a practice is to read the ksuba in front of the chassan and the two eidim to go over or go over more or less what it says, which is that if the chassan obligates himself to support his wife and obligates himself to a certain amount of money if the wedding should dissolve. Many had the practice of omitting the kanina till the kabbalas kinyan actually take place, but Bebulig noted that it's really yatzis charbev sedo, and there's no problem writing it before the whole ksuba is written before, even though none of it took place. So why people pick on Vikanina as the one thing that hasn't taken place yet? How can we write it? The Ksuba also says that Vahavale the Insukidas Mashav Yisrael, that we got married, none of that happened yet. So the same way none of that happened yet, we shouldn't necessarily harp on the Vikanina that didn't happen yet either. The Kabbalah's Kiddush should be done using either the Sudar of the Eidim or really of the Mesadar Kiddushin. So you should come to the wedding with a pen, or in the olden days they used to use yarmulkes, or handkerchiefs, whatever you want to do to use for a suda for the Kabbalah's Kinyan. That's all the Chassan's Tish, but moving on. To the Kiddushin itself. So the Kiddushin itself is accomplished, as we know from the first Mishnah, Maseches Kiddushin, in one of three ways, Bekesef, Beshtar, Ubebiya. Nonetheless, Shulchan Aruch says in Siman Chav Zayin, Nogu Mekadesh Dafka Bekesef. We have the minig of being Mekadesh Dafka with Kesef, and the Ramah says the minig is Dafka to use a ring. You can look into the Svarim as to why Dafka we have that minig. Some I saw last week's parasha, that's why Yehuda gave Tamar his signet ring, because they already dates back to the times of Chumash that they were being Mekadesh with Tabas. Okay. So it dates back perhaps an old minig to be Mekadesh Dafka with Kesef, and Dafka with the Tabas. What if you don't have a ring? So the Be'er Heitev writes in Simchav Zayin, Sif Aleph, in the name of the Mordechai, that you cannot use cash, because cash has symbols on it. That's what gives it its value. So daita tzurasa, but tzurasa vidi the bottle. Her mind is on, she has a mind. The tzura and the tzura get rubbed out. The Pesachei Tshuva, though, quotes the name of Miluam, the Aruch HaShulchan, who all disagreed. And they held, no, of course you get married dafka with cash. That's the whole Kiddush HaKesef. If it's with cash, you certainly get married with cash. The Pesachei Tshuva quotes the name of the Pesachei Tshuva and Chosh Mishpat, quotes the name of Sam Sofer, anything that's Bein Adam L'Chaveroi, not like Pidin HaBen, which is Bein Adam, and that's also Bein Adam L'Chaveroi. Anytime it's Bein Adam L'Chaveroi, you could use paper money too. I've never been at a wedding where they use paper money for Kesef Kiddushin, but in theory, if you don't have a ring, you could use another form of Kesef, Shove Kesef, or even perhaps cash, even perhaps paper money, which is representative value, not inherent value. The Shulchan Aruch says in Siman Lamed Aleph that the tabas has to be worth a shavar pruta. What, most of our rings, though, are worth much more than a shavar pruta, but it has to be something that has a known value. Even though she's not up to date on the prices of gold or silver or platinum, but the people are generally aware of the value of these items. But if it's a ring with a stone, which is... That's really, you never know how much a stone is worth unless you get it appraised. So it says in Shulchan Aruch, since people make a mistake, based on Rabbeinu Tam and Tosfos Kiddushin, since people make a mistake about how much it's really worth, she might think it's worth much more than it really is. You should not supposed to get married with a ring that has a stone. If it has just engravings, again, the custom is not to use wedding rings with any engravings, just a simple gold ring. But Maker Adin is probably okay if it has, some even wipe out the 14K on the inside of the ring. It's like an engraving, maybe. But we know that doesn't increase the value of the ring at all. So, but she might think if it has like a fleur-de-lis that it's like a fancy ring, he got it custom made, But most assume that the engravings, no one really thinks it make the ring worth much more than it should be worth. Yeah.
If I remember when I got married, I thought the ring was much more than it was.
That's because you're just ignorant of the prices of gold and silver and platinum.
But I assume most people are ignorant.
It doesn't matter. That's a commodity that everyone knows. All gold is worth the same. So we all know gold is of value, but not tremendous value. Stones, the range is just it's tremendous. That's why engravings most feel is really not such much of an issue. The Ramah says if you get married with a regular ring, so the assumption is that it's gold. If it's silver, you should really tell her that it's silver. She might think that it's white gold. Platinum is really the same as gold, so you don't really have to mention that. But if it's silver, you should let her know that it's silver instead of a stam ring is gold. The Ramah says in Siman Lamed Aleph Sif Beis, you're supposed to ask the Eidim underneath the chuppah if it's worth a shavar pruta, so that the Eidim should know it's worth a shavar pruta, and so that the kagel should have in mind to get married with a simple shavar pruta. So she knows it's worth a shavar pruta, that she has a mind to get married, That's one of the reasons the Ramah says that Kala covers over her face with a veil, is because she has a mind to get married, whatever the ring is worth. She's not even interested in seeing the ring. Whatever it's worth, it's worth, it's fine. She hasn't okay with it. That's why the Pesach Tshuva says, if Kala Dalit in the name of some Achrayim, now that she uses a veil, she's not looking at the ring. Maybe you could use a ring that has a stone. Because Rabbi Sheffler quotes like that from Moshe Soloveitchik. Now that she covers her face with the veil, and we ask her, are you okay getting married with a ring that's just a Sheva Pruta? So then perhaps you could even use a ring that has a stone. But Lamai says that's not the custom to do that. Yeah.
No.
Shulchan Aruch says in Simen Chav Ches that, of course, the ring has to belong to the husband. Avnei Miluim discusses that we know Kenyan, Dvar Torah, Mos, Konos. What really establishes a Kenyan is paying for it. Meshicha is only a Kenyan mid Rabbanon. Therefore, you should make sure to pay for the ring. The chassid should make sure to pay for the ring before the wedding. He discusses what if you only use meshicha, which is a kinyan derabbanan. Does a kinyan derabbanan work for a sub, you know, for an issue d'oraisa like kiddushin? That's where that whole lavdusha topic you might have come across in your iyun shiur once, you know, years in yeshiva. Does a kinyan derabbanan work for d'oraisa? That's where the avnei miluim brings that up.
So
the credit card, yeah. So some pay, maybe you should pay the credit card bill before, and you get involved in yeshivish discussions of. That's a hack, you know. But you should try to make sure that he pays for it. Shouldn't be a loan, you know. I'll pay you. The Shulchan Aruch says, Simchav Ches, if you test, that you can use a borrowed ring for Kiddushin, because it's kind of like a Matanah Manas Lahaksi, where the Shulchan Aruch says, and Simchav does work. Pesachei Tshuva quotes in Mishkanes Yaakov that Matanah Manas Lahaksir does not work, which gets involved in, again, the Lamdash Shemachleikis about Matanah Manas Lahaksir. Is it a full Matanah for a limited amount of time, or perhaps it's not a full matana since the time is limited, it's only a partial matana. The machlek is, can you get married with a ring that was given to you as a matana manas lahasir? You can't give it to a woman as a matana manas lahasir, that's daimel lechalip, and that's what the Gemara says is no good. What if the ring was given to the chassan as a matana manas lahasir? That's the discussion in the Shulchan Aruch and the Mishnah. The Beis Shmuel writes in Simchav Ches, the Masada Kiddushin, she asked the Chassan in front of the witnesses, does the ring belong to you? So he has to ask two questions, okay? The keeping score. Is the ring worth a Sheva Pruta, and does it belong to you? What about if the girl's family has an heirloom ring that they want to give to the Chassan to give back to the girl as the, you know, the Kiddushin ring, kind of like a sentimental item? So Pesachei Tshuva quotes in the Chassam Sefer, that there's a Ibai de Loyev Shita in the Gemara Masechtas Kiddushin, can she give the husband paper to write a get? Because when she gives him the paper, she knows she's going to get the paper right back. So the question is, does she really have in mind to give it to him fully in the first place, knowing she's going to get it right back? It's a very nuanced kinyan. Can a woman make such a nuanced kinyan? So that's a Ibai de Loyev Shita in the Gemara Masechtas Gidin, Adav Chafa Mebeis, and the Chassam Sefer raises that issue with regards to Kiddushin. Can she give him a ring knowing she's going to get it back for Kiddusha? Does she really have in mind to give it to him fully in the first place? So that's a machlokes, modern day poskim. Rabbi Yashiv held no, Rabbi Avadia held yes.
Isn't it easy enough just the family gives it, not
right? Okay. Yeah. Such a stipulation. So that's the Kiddusha. What about the chuppah? So the Shulchan Aruch writes in Simon Samach Aleph Sif Aleph, a machlokes between the Ramam and the Ran, whether or not you can have a chuppah's nida. Chuppas nida, okay, or perhaps it doesn't work. Why? Because this machlekes is really a machlekes. What is chuppah in the first place? According to the Rambam, chuppah is yichud haroi labia, yichud that's fit for relations. So therefore, chuppas nida, you cannot have yichud haroi labia. Therefore, you cannot have a chuppah. The opinion of the Ran, though, and that's the way Ashkenazim at least paskin, is that chuppah is knisa l'reshusai, a kind of symbolic entering into his reshus, which we symbolize by the two poles and cloth that goes on top. That's, by the way, I saw the Sfarim say, that's why Yehuda gave her not only a signet ring, I was so impressed by this, he gave her what else? A walking stick and his cloak. Those are the poles that would hold up the chuppah. Fantastic, no? Anyway, so that's similar, right, to the Ashkenazim. That symbolizes chuppah, which is a symbolic knisa l'reshusai. So that's why the Ramah paskins that you can have a chuppas nida. My impression is from the Tshuvas of Rabbi Avadia that even Sfaradim will now do a chuppas nida. They don't refrain from doing a chuppas nida. What do you do if you have a chuppas nidah? Rabbi Willer claimed, of course, you could avoid it all with aigestin. It's an avoidable problem nowadays. But let's say you encounter such a chuppas nidah. What do you do about giving the kala the ring? So he mentioned that Rabbi Salvechik was machmir, that not to put the ring on a finger, but to drop it into her hand because of a problem with passing things, and you might come to touch her finger inadvertently while you're putting the ring on her finger. So the Itar Paiskim quotes like that from the Be'er Heitev, who quotes like that from the Maril, who was machmir not to put the ring on her finger. But the Itar Paiskim quotes many Paiskim who disagreed, because the harchakas of passing don't exist yet, because they're not married. There's nothing wrong with passing something to a girl who's not your wife, who happens to be an Ida. It's only because there's already a close relationship between husband and wife that we're afraid passing things will lead to something more serious. And more than that, Yushalmi says in Masechta Saita that when the Kayin would do Hanafa, would do, wave the Mincha Saita together with the Isha Saita, their hands would touch for a brief moment. Since it was in front of a large group, there was no, the Yetzirah doesn't function in that short amount of time in the presence of a large group. So too, the Itar Paiskim says there's no Yetzirah by passing the ring to the even Ishtonida in the presence of such a large group for such a brief period of time. And certainly, if it's inadvertent that you might touch her finger, there shouldn't be room for concern. So to put the ring on her finger, most Paiskim, even by Chuppas Nida, would allow it. The Ramah says, since we paskin like the Ramah, that like the Ram, that is Kenisa or Shusa, the chuppah should be poles, with a cloth that spread on top. Rav Shechter in the Sefer Bikvei Atzon and Simon Lamed Tes has many minhagim. He discusses many minhagim of a wedding. One of the issues he discusses there, that according to some paiskim, it should be a kasher tzuras haPesach. I hate to bring back bad memories from Aaron, perhaps, but it should be a kasher tzuras haPesach. It shouldn't be min atzad. It should be al gabehem, in order to symbolize a proper knisa l'rishusa. I don't think we're really machmer on that, but some achronim have that notion. Rav Shechter also claims that perhaps it's based on the chuppah is based on, like a pasuk can say from Megillas Rus, of ufarasta kanafecha la maseka, you spread your cloth over her, like a spreading the talis over the chasen and kala, like the minig by the yekes. So that's why the chuppah should also be a cloth. We will mention this too. Rav Shechter has it in the Big Vayetzon. Yeah.
So if I have to be like, I know someone who's recently had a wedding made a very nice pool, but they forgot to put something over. So the rabbi said, so we're going to have like someone hold a talus over them with four people.
Right.
So if there are no poles in the family, they could just serve as a pesach. So
that's fine. Yeah. Okay. They used to have people holding poles. They used to hold poles.
That but this was holding poles. It was like just people holding up
them. Yeah. The Ramah quotes another opinion, though, about what is chuppah, that it's mishayatzas behinuma, when she goes out with a veil over her face, and that's quoted by the Drisha, the Dagum Mirvava and Hilchos Avelos and Simon Shin Mem Beis of all places, that's perhaps how we should paskin. That is when Misha Yatzis Beinuma, when she goes out with her face covered, which is why we do the Bedekin, as another position about how to fulfill the Inyan of Nisuin. But that's really a Chumrah in terms of how to perform Nisuin. Do you need Edim? We know you need Edim by the wedding. We'll get to that in a second. Do you need Edim by the Nisuin? Is a discussion that's only found in the later Achronim, the Or Sameach, the Marcheshes, who was a contemporary of Reb Chaim Oizer, a little bit before Reb Chaim Oizer. So it's from the much later Achronim. The Avnei Miluim discusses it too, but it's from the later Achronim. We have a discussion: do you need Edim by the Nisuin? And some of the later Achronim explain that really hinges on how you understand Nisuin. Is Nisuin just like is it a second stage of marriage? There's Kiddushin, then there's Nisuin. Or perhaps Nisuin is really just a completion of the first stage of marriage. She's an Eishes Ish Shalei Bebeis Habal, and she just becomes an Eishes Ish Bebeis Habal. But even from the Kiddushin, the marriage was already completed. So that's an afkamina. Do you need Edim there? If it's the second stage of marriage, then just like the first stage needs witnesses, the second stage too. If it's just completing, the Knisa L'Reshusa of making her an Eishes Ish Shalei Bebeis Habal to now Bebeis Habal, then perhaps you shouldn't need witnesses there. Either way, I don't think it makes sense to require witnesses by the Bedekin. It's well known if Salvechik required, sometimes required witnesses by the Bedekin, but Lefianiyas Daiti, according to the Lum, this makes no sense at all. Because how do we have a Nisuin before Kiddushin? The Bedekin is taking place before the Kiddushin. So that's a discussion the Mishnah Lemelech has. Can you have Nisuin before Kiddushin? Maybe yes, maybe no. What does that issue hinge upon? See, Achronim again explained on what is Nisuin. If Nisuin is just fulfilling a condition of the marriage, that it be Bebeis Habal, so then okay, it could even happen before the Kiddushin. You can have that condition fulfilled, she can be Bebeis Habal, then she becomes an Eishes Ish. But if it's a second stage of marriage, They're supposed to follow a first stage of marriage, and you can't have nisuin before kiddushin. So the only reason you should require witnesses is if it's a second stage of marriage. If it's a second stage of marriage, it can't happen before the kiddushin. So in my mind, to have witnesses by the bedekin, I don't think makes any logical sense. I think Rabbi Wug, you know, tipped his hand at the end as to why Rav Soloveitchik insisted upon it was because he was very opposed to meaningless ceremonies. So he told people to have witnesses by the bedek, and they shouldn't just think that it's a time to give brachas and it's not really a significant part of the wedding. In order to underscore its significance, he made them have witnesses there. The practice is to be miyachid for when it comes to the kiddushin. Of course, their witnesses is integral, is essential, that you have to have witnesses by the kiddushin. If there's no witnesses, the kiddushin is meaningless. We have the practice of setting aside special be miyachid edim. The Avnei Miluim recommend to do that in order to avoid the problem of Nimsa Echameham Karvo Pasul. If one of the witnesses is found to be no good, then the entire group of witnesses is no good. So we have a problem over here. They have a whole audience watching the wedding. If we're not going to set aside special witnesses, so some people in the audience are craving, some may be psulim, so then the whole group will be pasuliedus. Now the truth of the matter is, that's really only when people come to testify in court that the rule of Nimsachamayim Karvu Pasul functions. It doesn't exist by an Eid HaRoya, it's really only by an Eid HaMeid. Nonetheless, the Ritva Mesechtas Makkah says, by giving the Kiddushin, there is no Eid HaMeid. It's Eidus Lekiyam HaDavar, simply seeing the matter is what creates the Kiddushin. So it could be, when it comes to giving the Kiddushin, an Eid HaRoya is like an Eid HaMeid. That's what the Ksois HaChoshin bases this upon. Is that perhaps by giving the kiddushin there's a chumra that the eid haroya is like an eid hamayid, and therefore nimsachamayim karvu pasul becomes a real problem. So if the practice is to be machmir like that ritva, and to set it, if you really didn't do it, it's probably kosher too. But that is the practice based on the ritva that perhaps giving the kiddushin, simply seeing the matter, the rule of nimsachamayim karvu pasul should apply. And therefore, we set aside witnesses.
Do we worry about gambling with regards to kashrus of witnesses? Like, let's say, for instance, like, you know that the chassan went to Vegas with some of his buddies, and those are his edim.
I would probably insist that the edim be, you know, of higher court. We can do better than that, you know.
Right.
If you can't do better than that at the wedding, then okay, you can't. But if you can do better than that, I think we can do better than that. The whole idea of saying to the exclusion of all others is based on the language of a Rosh Mesechtas Ksubos. But many people have the notion that I'm like a kind of posseling everybody else le'edos. You cannot possel people le'edos. If you could, no murderer would ever be convicted just before killing the other party. You would just say, I possel you all le'edos, you're all excluded. You can't do that. What it means is to say, it's kind of like just emphasizing the point that you're a separate group of edim than everybody else, which doesn't really make sense in our context. It's not common practice by Mesadrei Kiddushin to do that. The Ramah says in Siman Mem Beis Sif Daled that the Edom are supposed to see the Kiddushin itself. Not just know it took place, but to actually see it. Not be an aid, Edos Yediyah, but have Edos Re'iyah. That's what the Beis Shmuel says, they actually have to see it. Others disagree, because the Gemara says in Mesechtas Kiddushin at the end, Hein Hein Ede Yichud, Hein Hein Ede Biyah. That if you see people secluding together, that's kind of like Eidos, that they had relations, even though they didn't see the relations themselves. So you see, Eidos Yediyah itself can be good enough, but we try and insist on Eidos Re'iyah.
Then we say by Sota, Polish Shofaris, like, so did you see the Hassan holding the ring?
Correct. To convict someone of Misa, you need Kemichol B'Shofaris. When it comes to Kiddushin, if a couple got divorced, stay over the night together in a hotel, we say, Hein Hein Ede Yichud, Hein Hein Ede Biyah, and they're married again. So you see, at least by Kiddushin, we say, Hein Hein Ede Yichud, Hein Hein Ede Biyah. So therefore, a Moshe quotes from the Chassam Sofer, that let's say it turns out right after the chuppah, unfortunately this is more common in our times, it's becoming more common, all of a sudden, you know, they come, the feds love coming to the weddings and arresting people from the wedding. Feds come, arrest the witnesses, you know, from the wedding, and now, you know, we have to redo the wedding if the witnesses get arrested. So, the Ramesha says from the Chassam Sofer that no, as long as the Masada Kiddushin was a Rav Muvhak, he's a person who knows what he's doing, so then we could assume that the wedding was carried out properly, and everybody else who's in the audience could serve as Edim for the Kiddushin. However, we should try, even though they didn't see the Kiddushin itself, they're just standing in the back of the room, b'diyeva, that's okay too. Pesach Yeshiva quotes him the Ma'arit in the name of his father, the Ma'abit, that the Mechsada Kiddushin should lift up the veil to look at the face of the cow to make sure that it's her. Now, if you're in a community like in many of our communities, we don't have the deck tickle, you know, so it's not so thick you can see the face of the cow through the veil. Now, obviously, this issue doesn't come up, but if you're in those types of communities where the veil is literally like a piece of satin, you know, like four layers of satin, you can't see the face of the kala, so then the Ma'abit has a good argument. How do you know that this is the kala anymore? You might have seen her a few hours ago, but this might be a Maisa, Rachel, and Leah. How do you know who this is anymore? So the Masada Kedushin should lift it up, that the Edom should see who the kala is, and the Chatzin, of course, should see who the kala is. The Ma'arit, though, disagrees, and he says, no, come on, she's the only girl here with a white dress, and, you know, it looks more or less like the girl we just saw at the Shmorg. We know who it is. You don't really have to do this. Edus Yediyah is good enough. I think Rabbi Wilg is Machmer on that. Shefta too, but you figure out how to negotiate that issue. When it comes to making the brachos, so it says in Shulchan Aruch Simon Lamed Aleph Sif Beis, a big machlekes between the Rosh and the Rambam. What is the nature of the Birchas Eirusin? Is it a Birchas Shevach Vahidah, or is it a Birchas HaMitzvah? The Rosh in Masechtas Kiddushin is well known as saying it's a Birchas Shevach Vahidah, because the Nusach HaBracha doesn't reflect, you know, correspond to the Nusach HaBracha of a Birchas HaMitzvah that we're accustomed to, and the Rambam's opinion is that it's a Birchas HaMitzvah and the Mitzvah of getting married. The Shulchan Aruch says we have the minig of making it before the Kiddushin takes place, like the Rambam. Nonetheless, the Chalkas Machaik and the Beis Shmuel say, Me'ikra, then we passing like the Rosh, and therefore if you got to make it before, you can make it afterwards. But since we're L'chachil HaMachmer like the Rambam, that it's a Birchas HaMitzvah, you should try and avoid a hefsik between the Bracha and the Chatzin saying Arei Mekudeshesli and giving the ring to the Kala. So therefore, Rav Shechler is of the opinion, he explains this in Bikvei Atzon Simul Lamentes, that Masada Kedushin should ask all of his questions to the Edim. Is it worth a Shepaputa? Is it yours? You should ask that all before the bracha. Call the Edom up, ask all your questions. I'll tell you, common practice is not to do that. Common practice is to make the bracha, then the Masada Kiddushin asks the Edom the questions, then the Chassan gives the Kala the ring with Harei Mekudeshesli. But he suggests that perhaps that it would be better if you would do it before the bracha. The Ramah says in Simon Lamedalin, the minhag is that the chassan does not make this bracha himself. The bracha is given to somebody else. So the Beis Shmuel, even though it's the chassan's mitzvah of getting married, so the Beis Shmuel says, it's not in order not to embarrass the chassan. We have a hard enough time getting the chassan to get out the one line of Harei Mekudeshes Libit HaBazuk, that's mentioned for Yisrael correctly, let alone a bracha. So there is reason to be concerned, but many disagree. The Beis Shmuel quotes others who disagree that it's not because it's not to embarrass the chassan, it's because it's a Birchas Shevach Vahidah. So it should really not be made by the Chassan. It should be made by all who are present for giving Shevach Vahidah to HaKadosh Baruch Hu on the institution of marriage. So that's why Rabbi Shechter also writes in the Bikvei Atzon that the Masada Kiddushin should be someone then who represents not the Chassan and the Kala, but who represents the Hamoinam, everyone who's there in the audience. Who would we have chosen as the Masada Kiddushin? So that's why the common practice is to defer to the biggest Talmud Chacham in the room. You know, maybe we'll also express this hesitation. You know, it just doesn't look right when the Chassan's Rebbe flies in from Eretz Yisrael and he's 25 and you have great Goyim and Gedolim there to give the Masada Kiddushin to be the Chassan's Rebbe, no matter how close they are. It's just not the right thing to do. You should always defer to the person who's the Rosh HaKol who's there, because it really is perhaps the Brach of the Tzibur that's being given over to the Masada Kiddushin. When it comes to the Nusach of Kiddushin, so you make the bracha, by the way, then you give the chasen kala to drink. Don't forget to give, of course, the chasen kala to drink. Then, after you give him the chasen kala to drink, then the chasen makes his statement. So, says the Shulchan Aruch, even if he gets the statement wrong, if asukim bo'isa inyin, the whole sugya in the beginning of Masechet Kiddushin, so then we know what you mean, it's probably okay. So, Chashulchan writes, look, we're all in a wedding hall, where, you know, chasen's wearing a tuxedo, the kala's wearing a white dress, we all know what's going on. This is Ein Asukim Be'Oisa Inyan G'day L'Bizu. He probably doesn't have to say anything. We would know what's going on. But at the same time, he should get the line out properly. I always tell Chassanim, when I'm a Masada Kiddushin, you have one line here. You know, get it right. You know, just say, this is your one line. We don't really do the repeat after me anymore. I've never seen that done. Because either way, Asukim Ba'isein, they probably don't even have to say anything, make her a din. But the chasson is showing if he's a ben Torah, can get away with the one line. You know, he doesn't need to repeat after me. He should, Rabbi Wilk mentioned, he should put the ring on her finger after he says his line. Why? Because otherwise we're afraid it's an engagement present. He gives her a ring. She says, now what? Now what do I get for the Kiddushin? So you should really put it on her finger after the Kiddushin. This is your ring for Kiddushin, not a wedding present. Lixav Sofer writes in his Truvas, if he messes that up, we don't make them do it again. Because either way, we all know what you mean. The Be'er Hetev writes in Siman Samach Aleph that he's supposed to put from his right hand to her right hand. If he's a lefty, it's in the left hand, but it should be from right here, his right hand to her right hand. The minig is that you stick out the finger. That's the, you know, the, she could put on her ring finger later, but you stick out the ring finger is obviously a very difficult thing. So the minig is you stick out the pointer finger.
Is it, what's the reason why? It's because
this is a chash of a finger too, and
it doesn't fit.
You put it on the end, and then she puts it on her ring finger. That's what you do.
But what's the reason why? Because it's a chash of finger.
It's a set in Be'er Hetev. Just two notes about the few notes about the Sheva Brachas, and then what if you lose the Ksuba? So the Pischei Tshuva writes in Siman Samach Beis Sifkan Yud Beis of Machlekes Achrayim. When do you start counting the time of Sheva Brachas? We know there's 7 days, but when do you start counting? You start counting from the time of the Chuppah, or from the time of the Seuda. So Chalkas Machlekes' opinion is from the time of the Chuppah. The Knesset Yechezkel, classic Achrayim's opinion is you start from the time of the Seuda. Big difference if the Chuppah happens before the Shkia, the Seuda is after the Shkia, which is day one of Sheva Brachas. The minig is like the Knesset Yechezkel that you start counting. No, you start counting from the time of the chuppah. I have my notes over here wrong. You start counting from the time of the chuppah. Correct. Not from the time of the Suda. I think in the Rabbi Felder's book, A Holy Yeshurin, which he has many original things for Rav Moshe, he writes over there in the name of Rav Moshe that he thought you could be Mako, meaning which gives you an extra day Sheva Brachas. Depends how you look at it. Make or laugh at the end, you're already ready to be done with it. The chas and kal, the parents, we've all had enough. But he quotes from Ramesha that perhaps you could be Samech on the Knesset Yechezkel, they go based on the time of the Suda. But the minig is from the time of the Chuppah. So if the Chuppah happens before the Shkia, that's day one. And it ends earlier. The Pischei Tshuva says you do not go based on Me'es Lies. It's not 24-hour periods. It does not go Me'es Lies. So therefore, if the Chuppah happened let's say the chuppah happened on Sunday before the Shkia, the last of the Sheva Brachas will be Shabbos. And Shabbos, it should really be done before the Shkia. You don't go Me'es Lies, not 24-hour periods. So it should really be, Shabbos should really end before the Shkia. So you should really make the Sheva Brachas over. You have to make Sheva Brachas before Mincha, or before Shalina, before, make Shal Shudas early. You have Mincha early, make Shal Shudas early. Really not supposed to continue on after the Shkia, which is a very common thing that happens. You have to be aware. It happened at my wedding. You have to be aware of it. So we once had here in Yeshiva, Sheva Brachas, interesting cases, and there was a Rosh Yeshiva here who paskin, the go Me'es Lies. So, but they didn't have any Svarim there. So everyone else said, no, you don't go Me'es Lies. He said, I'm telling you, you go Me'es Lies. So they said, fine, you make all the Sheva Brachas. So he did. He made all the, but he was wrong. You don't go Me'es Lies. Yeah.
So if we end on Friday nights and on Shabbos, you can't just say Shabbos continues.
So Rav Moshe held that the day goes on, again, Rabbi Felder quotes this from Rav Moshe, that the day goes on based on what we still call Shabbos. So he held till 40 minutes after the Shkia, we still call it Shabbos, so you can still make Sheva Brachas. So if you get in a pickle, you could be, so you look it up, you, in the Sefer HaHolei Yeshurin, you could look it up. He quotes from Rav Moshe. And the seventh day, you can see, you still have perhaps 40 minutes after the Shkia, because it goes based on what we call the seventh day. But that's not, Ramesh is unique in that way. If you mess up in the Sheva Brachas, in the Be'er Hetev and Siman Samach Beis Sifkan Aleph, he quotes him in Igeres HaRambam, that the Seder is not Miyakev. At the same time, Ramesh quotes in the name of the Atzei HaRozim, which is a classical acronym on Shulchan Aruch Eben HaEzer, there is two Brachas that are Miyakev. If you say, Asher Yotzar to Adam Mitzal 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 Mitzal, you can no longer say Yotzar Adam. Yotzar Adam is on the creation of man. Asher Yotzar describes the creation of man. So you can't say, after you describe the creation of man, go back and say, by the way, thank you for creating man in the first place. And that was how Rav Soloveitchik felt. It's quoted in the Sefer Nefesh HaRav. But it says in the Nefesh HaRav that one time they messed up on that exact bracha, and there were only six brachas, but seven rabbanim who needed kibudim, and Rav Soloveitchik felt that they could say the bracha Yotzer Adam after Asher Yotzer, in order, like, cover up Bria's issue. for the Rav who didn't get the bracha. Just do whatever you want to do about that. Sheva brachas, you only get 7 days if it's a bachur who's marrying an almana, or an alman who's marrying a psula. Someone over here is their first time getting married. Pesachei Tshuva and Siman Samech Beis of Cotton Test quotes an interesting pshat from the Neid of Yehuda that if they're both bu'ulois, they only get 1 day Sheva brachas. Common. More common than you would think. If they're both Bu'ulo, it's only 1 day Sheva Brachas. Even if they were never married. So Chassam Sofer disagrees. Chassam Sofer says, no, it has to do with the Chiddush of being married, not the newness of being the first time having relations, the first time having Bia, has to do with the first time being married. Even if they're both Bu'ulo, there are 7 day Sheva Brachas. But it's an interesting psak from the Neid of Yehuda. But even the Neid of Yehuda holds if it was Bu'ulas Atzmai. Maybe if it was you were the one who made her a bula, maybe there's room to negotiate. One final inyan is, what if they lose the ksuba? So first of all, so it says in Shulchan Aruch Siman Samech Vav Siv Gimel that they're not allowed to be misyached with one another without a ksuba. The Ramah just says they're not allowed to have bia, they're not allowed to have relations with one another without a ksuba. Not that there's an iser yichud. That's a big distinction between the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah. But in the Sefer Ksuba Kehilchasai, he quotes an important psak from Rav Vosner. Let's say they get back to the hotel, it's 2 o'clock in the morning, they can't find the Ksuba. So he assumes that someone took the Ksuba. It's somewhere. He says, unless you know that it fell out the limousine as you were driving over the Brooklyn Bridge into the river, someone took it back, they pack everything up and took it back with, someone has it. You shouldn't assume that it's lost. Unless you know that it's lost. But let's say you know that it's lost. Yeah. Or it's years later, not the night after the wedding. You know you don't have the ksuba. So the Shulchan Aruch writes over there in Siman Samech Vav Sif Aleph that if the Edim are still alive, who made the Kabbalah, who watched the Kabbalah's kinyan of the Chasan, so we don't even need the Shtar. We could just call the Edim and say, oh, we witnessed it. We saw the Chasan be Makabal kinyan on the obligations of the ksuba. So they're still alive. So then Shulchan Aruch says there's no Isser Yichud or Isser Bia. The Ramah disagrees, though. It says he cannot rely on the witnesses even if they're still alive. You need to have the document. But the Ramah says that there's a Cherem de Rabbeinu Gershon, that you can't divorce your wife against her will. So the whole reason you need the Ksuba shouldn't be Kala Be'en of Laitzia, shouldn't be able to dismiss her willy-nilly, you know, without any consequences, without any financial obligations. But you can't do that nowadays anyway. There's a Cherem de Rabbeinu Gershon, you can't divorce your wife against her will. So the Ramah says, so what's the concern anymore in our times? So even if there's no ksuba, should be no iser bia. But the Beis Shmuel and the Chalkas Mechaykek disagree. And they say, no, you can't rely on the Cherem de Rabbeinu Gershon. But the Ramah felt he could rely on the Cherem de Rabbeinu Gershon. So as long as the witnesses are still alive, and you have the Cherem de Rabbeinu Gershon, so then we could probably put those two together to come out with a kula. So if the witness, if it happened right after the wedding, even if you know the ksuba was lost, perhaps there's room over there to be makel. Rav Shechter once told me, and this happened at a wedding, that there was a mistake with the ksuba. We realized underneath the chuppah there was a mistake with the ksuba. So do you say they can't go to the yichud room? Can we just read it as it's supposed to have been? Or do we have to prevent them from going to the yichud room until we redo the ksuba? There is no valid ksuba here. So Rav Shechter thought you could put these two reasons together, the Cherem de Rabbeinu Gershon and the witnesses are still here at the wedding, so that they could go to the yichud room, even though we don't have a proper ksuba.
It's worse, though, because you don't have a ksuba in the first place. It's worse than having...
But the witnesses are here. We witnessed the Kabbalah's kinyan. The shtar ksuba is just a riot to that.
The shtar ksuba...
We could just have the witnesses in court and say, yeah, he obligated himself to the obligations of marriage, of what the ksuba entailed.
The ksuba was wrong, though.
Correct. So that's not, it's not a shtar riot. But it is... But he did obligate himself to those obligations. Okay.
Anyone would lose it?